I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 170 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. I've been circling around this week's guest for quite a while. I've talked with three other members of his band, The Baseball Project, three producers of his more famous former band, two auxiliary members of that band, and that band's publicist. Now, at last, we're excited to bring you Mike Mills of REM. Let's show the kids how to do it fine. Mills may not have released a solo project since REM called it quits after its 2011 album Collapse Into Now. But the band's bassist, keyboardist, what have you, has kept plenty busy. He wrote and toured with his Concerto for Violin, Rock Band, and String Orchestra, which debuted in 2016. He has played in concerts celebrating the work of the band Big Star. He is a member of The Baseball Project with fellow REM alumnus Peter Buck, plus drummer Linda Pittman, and singer-songwriter-guitarists Scott McCoy and Steve Wynn. Yes, the last three are all Caro Pop alumni. Mills has guested on numerous projects, including Amplificado, the third album from Jason Narducci's band Split Single. Now, Mills is forming a new band with Hootie and the Blowfish singer-songwriter Darius Rucker, former Black Crowes drummer Steve Gorman, and Nashville guitarist Tom Bukovic. Mills talks about that project here, including how much songwriting he's doing and how the members collaborate. I'm such a huge longtime fan of REM and Mills that it was hard to narrow down what to discuss in an hour-long conversation. So we'll go with the flow here. Jason Narducci and actor-singer Michael Shannon currently are touring behind the 40th anniversary of REM's third album, Fables of the Reconstruction, and previously performed shows celebrating Murmur. Mills not only has seen the Shannon Narducci interpretation of REM, but has joined them on stage. How does he feel about them touring behind his band's material? Has experiencing those songs from the audience instead of the stage given Mills any new perspective on the work? Do these performances nudge him toward wanting to play again with REM bandmates Michael Stipe, Peter Buck, and Bill Berry? What's the story behind the original foursome playing Losing My Religion upon their induction into the Songwriters Hall of Fame last June? How did REM come to share songwriting credits on all songs, and why did Mills initially object? Mills wrote on such REM songs as Night Swimming, Find the River, Don't Go Back to Rockville, What's the Frequency, Kenneth, Electrolyte, and many others. How did the band's songwriting collaborations work? Why did Mills wind up singing lead on Near Wild Heaven and Texarkana? Why wouldn't REM smile in photographs? What role did producers play in making those REM albums? What songs did Michael Stipe transform in surprising ways when he added lyrics and vocals to other members' music? Are there REM songs where the music was handed off to Stipe but didn't get to the finish line? Would they ever revisit any of those old songs? How did the songwriting change when Bill Berry left the band? Why is Mills more comfortable as a harmony singer than lead vocalist? What, if anything, is happening with a possible solo album that Mills has discussed over the years? What does Mills call the coolest thing that's ever happened? Hint, it involves Bruce Springsteen. Mills is as down-to-earth and insightful as you'd expect. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Mike Mills. Whatever it takes, I'm giving. What are you doing right now? What's your next tour or show or project?
I actually have a really cool project going on right now with some guys. We don't have a name yet, but we got most of a record done.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's with Steve Gorman from the Black Crowes and Tom Bukovic, great guitar player from Nashville, and Darius Rucker. So when we get a name, we'll start putting that one out there.
So are you, is this one of these, is it sort of a democratic thing where everyone's contributing songs, or how does it work?
Yeah, it's everybody. We just agreed with the same with this early on, we split all the songwriting. So everybody does whatever they can do towards the song.
So it's one of those things like REM where everyone's sharing the credits for all of them.
That's correct. In that sense, yes.
And are you singing lead, background, harmonies?
Yes. The answer is yes. Play bass, probably play a little guitar, little keyboards. I can sing lead on one or two. A lot of harmonies, working on a dual vocal with Darius if I can get the song written. And Tom Bukovic plays keyboards and guitar as well, bass on one song. And Steve Gorman's a fantastic drummer.
Are these songs that you specifically wrote for this project?
All the songs were written for this project, yes.
So you have other songs that are possibly for other things, but this was just like fresh, new collaboration.
Well, you know, you write songs because that's what you do. They're not always for anything, but yes, for the last few months, I've been writing for this project.
Well, that's, I was kind of wondering about that, because there's some people who will only write when there's a project and others who just write. And
well, yeah, when you have a project specifically, then you have to, yes, then you have to sit down and do the work, in the sense of work as in, you know, energy times time. But, you know, anytime I sit down at a piano or pick up a guitar, I'm hoping something comes out. There's not always a dedicated reason to do that.
Right. But you'll just be like playing, you know, music on your, in your own life, and you'll be like, oh, okay, here's something, as opposed to
absolutely.
Now it's 8 o'clock and time for my songwriting session or something.
Right. I mean, I mean, when you know you have a project and you have to have songs, then you might spend a little more time at the piano or at the guitar than you would otherwise. But even when I don't have a project, if I'm playing an instrument, you're always hoping a song will come out of it.
Right. When you're writing for this project, is it a different process than when you're writing for REM? And that REM sort of seemed like it was kind of this unique, in these uniquely interlocking parts that created songs for REM. And I'm wondering, you know, when you're working with different musicians, if you're bringing different interlocking parts to it.
Not really, because, you know, you write the song on whatever instrument. Most of these are guitar. So you write the song on guitar, and then you show it to the guys, and everybody says, okay, I'll do this or I'll do that. I mean, Steve's going to play drums. Darius is going to sing. So it's usually between me and Tom as to, you know, who's going to play bass. Do we need some more guitar? Who's going to play keyboard? You know, it's very organic, like it should be.
Are you writing the lyrics, or are you handing those off to Darius?
I'm doing some of them. He's doing most of them, but I've got two songs so far where I've written the words, and I'm working on a third.
So last year I saw you in Baseball Project, which I've seen you in several times. You're also touring with Big Star. Like, how are you sort of figuring out what you're working on at this point? And is it basically like, this is the stuff that's just fun, I'm playing with friends and I'm making music and there's no pressure?
Yes, the idea is that it should be things you want to do. When REM broke up, you know, I took a year to try to figure out who I was and what I was going to do. And, you know, I said, I could just goof off and play golf the rest of my life. I said, but I don't think that's going to be very fulfilling. I'm a musician. I need to play. And once I made that decision, then things started coming in. You know, I play with, as you know, the Baseball Project, the Big Star stuff keeps coming back, which is super fun. We're about to do the Little Stevens Underground Garage cruise.
Right, I saw that.
So I'm playing in three bands on that. So, you know, you open yourself up to the universe, and eventually your friends and others will come calling. I certainly didn't see this new project coming down the road, but there it is.
When REM broke up, did you have people in other bands saying, oh, hey, you should be our bassist?
Not that I recall. It's funny. I just never got that much like outside work as a bass player. More as a background vocalist for things. I did get a lot of calls about that. I did a Super Chunk song, and
right.
I've done a few other things for some indie artists. But no, not as a bass player. Never got a whole lot of outside interest in that.
Right. You're here playing on that one split single album too.
That was super fun. I mean, that was just a project, you know. I've been a fan of Jason's and of course John Worster for a while, and Jason's songs are great. That's the reason I agreed to do. One of the reasons I agreed to do that is because Jason's a really good songwriter. So we made what I consider a really good record. I think Amplificado is a great record. I listen to it once in a while for fun. So that's a good sign for me.
So speaking of Jason and John, you were here at Metro when they and Michael Shannon played their Murmur show for the first time. And I think you were at the 40 Watt Club for when they played there. What is it like? I mean, obviously you went on stage too, but what is it like being in the audience, hearing those songs from that perspective when you're used to hearing them being on stage?
Well, being on stage is very different because you're not hearing the songs per se. You know, it's not like you can detach yourself and listen to it. You're playing it. You're you're trying not to mess it up. You know, you're trying to enjoy it. All those things that go into being in a band. Listening off the stage is very different. You know, I've heard people cover REM songs over the years before, and it's always interesting to see how somebody brings a point of view to it. This is different because this band is sort of hard to define in that it's not a tribute band. It's not really a cover band. It's a lot of really talented musicians bringing their point of view to the music while they're playing it as accurately as possible. And Michael Shannon, being an actor, he has a way of, I don't, there's no good word to use for what he does. I don't like channeling because he's not really, he's just singing, but he brings a certain presence that is not dissimilar to Michael's. That's right. The best way I can think to put it. So when you see it, it has its own thing. It is its own thing, and it has its own interest, even aside from being REM songs. It's an interesting group of musicians playing together. And the fact that they have some good material and they're all extremely talented makes it a lot of fun. I can see why this thing's a hit.
Did it prompt you to hear any of those songs differently?
I can't say that it did. It's probably a little late to change my opinions of REM songs at this point, but I say that, and then I say you can go back and listen to something you haven't heard in a while and go, wow, that was really great. So I guess, yes, having said that, listening to these songs does remind me of how good they really are. And that's exciting. It's good to see that a song can still have life and vitality after all those years and in someone else's hands.
I remember seeing in one of the stories, Michael Stipe saying, I'd never heard 9-9 from the audience. What a crazy song that is. Like, I hadn't even really thought of it that way.
Oh, I had. It's a very weird song. It's the beat kind of turns around in it. But what Bill Berry did on drums is just amazing. And I have always enjoyed the weirdness of that song. It's 929, just for what that's worth.
Oh, 929. See, I was just saying that. Yeah. Thank you. I've been saying it wrong all these years. Yeah, I saw you guys play that at Irvine Auditorium in the fall of 83 in Philadelphia. That was one of sort of the early shows I saw where it's like I knew the album, and then the live show made me think, holy cow, this is like different and more energetic and just totally transfixing.
Thank you.
How do you feel about just the fact that, you know, those guys, by the way, Michael Shannon, Jason, and everyone are on tour. They're doing Fables now and then a lot of other songs. Is it cool to have sort of a surrogate band out there since you guys aren't doing this and you obviously would be playing in much huger places if you were?
Well, it's a good feeling to know that they care enough about it to do this. It's also a good feeling that the audience cares enough to go see it. And all those things have to happen. If this was just a bunch of pikers, you know, trying to play rote cover songs, no one would be very interested in it. Right. But it's talented musicians who are bringing something special to it. And Michael Shannon's a great singer, which you have to have. I mean, if you're going to try to sing Michael Stipe's parts, you need to be able to bring everything to the table. And he does. And he nails it. And yet, it's his own thing. So it is kind of rewarding and gratifying that it can work on that level and that people can enjoy it.
And in no way, this is like the rote question for all of these interviews you do. It's not prompting you guys to think, oh, we should be doing this again.
No, that ship has sailed. You know,
it's you're very consistent on this, which is why I didn't want to just ask you, when are they going to get back together?
No, and it's fine. It's a logical question. I mean, we asked ourselves for years, you know, is there any reason? Is there any point? And we've never found a good enough reason to do it. So I think it's best left where it is. And, you know, thank goodness that it's still out there for anybody else to listen to or to play or to, you know, form their own band like these guys. It's the possibilities are all out there except for us playing them.
And when you guys were inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in June, you all played Losing My Religion together. And it wasn't like, you know, oh my God, it was just, you know, like this huge deal. It's just like, here are four guys who are in this band who still like each other and like the music. And you could do that without it, you know, blowing a hole in the universe or something.
Well, there were several factors that went into that. Number one, the Songwriters Hall of Fame is something that, you know, awards
are pretty ephemeral. And they're usually often just popularity contests. And obviously, if, you know, if we hadn't been a popular band, we would never have gotten that award. But that did matter. It did matter to us. And one of their one of the things about getting in was that all artists perform a song. And it would have been rather churlish of us not to do that, to accept that award and then say, nah, we're not going to follow. And it was also, it was just for the people there. You know, it was only for that audience, and it was not announced, and it was not a precursor to any other bigger thing. And we did, it was fine.
One cool thing, though, when we headed over to the instruments, it was an audible gasp from the audience, and that was kind of a cool thing.
And you're all still in touch with each other in Athens and everywhere else.
Oh, of course. Yeah, we see each other surprisingly often.
How much of a longevity did you guys buy yourselves by agreeing at the beginning you were just going to share in all the songwriting and the publishing, the royalties, the credit, all of that stuff?
Well, that was, as noted many times, that was one of the best decisions we ever made. You know, it was Peter's idea because he knew so much about rock and roll already, and he knew that, you know, of the things that break up bands, any unequal distribution of money is right there at the top of the list. I had an issue with it, not in the sense of the money, but because of credit. You know, if I wrote a great song, I wanted people to know I wrote it. But Peter's argument was unshakable and absolutely spot on correct, and it was the best thing we ever did.
As time has passed, are you more open to talking about how, you know, each song was written and how, you know, you'd written this one and Peter came in with this one and Bill came in with this one and this one was a collaboration? Because I think that because of all the shared credits, there's always this kind of curiosity over kind of who did what. And, you know, I don't know whether enough time has passed where you guys are like, yeah, we'll talk about that now.
Well, you know, it's funny. I remember one of my favorite interviews was John Lennon agreed to discuss some of the Beatles.
Right.
My favorite one was, so the guy was throwing out titles and Lennon would say, oh, okay, I wrote that and Paul wrote the middle eight or vice versa. And then the guy says, when I'm 64, and John just went, please.
I thought that was pretty revealing there. I wouldn't do it with every song, but we've talked about it over the years. I mean, we mentioned that Bill, you know, did the Genesis for Man on the Moon, wrote most of Everybody Hurts. You know, most of the piano stuff is mine, except for Lotus, which was Peter's. You know, that kind of stuff's pretty obvious. You know, I wouldn't want to sit and break down every song, but you know, you just got to figure most of them were Peter's, and then, you know, the middle eight could have come from either one of us. There's right. Just no, you know, yeah. I mean, if you have a couple you want to throw at me, I'll do it. But
I was going to say, and then the occasional guitar one, like What's the Frequency, Kenneth, was you.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I wrote a few of the guitar ones. Let Me In was mine, but I mean, that's just, you know, it's pretty straightforward. It's not like I wrote a magnum opus. It's a great song because of what Michael did with it. But yeah, I played guitar on a few things.
And Rockville's one that you actually wrote the lyrics to. Did you come in with lyrics and melodies for other ones, or was it really still a matter of handing off the music to Michael Stipe and seeing what happened with it?
Most of the stuff I sang is because Michael hit a roadblock. Near Wild Heaven, I think he might have said, let's just do that together. Texarkana, he got a little bit written and just got stumped. And I had some ideas, so we went ahead and threw that down. And Rockville, I wrote. I just wrote it to be writing it. And Michael used to sing it, actually. I did write the lyrics, but I didn't sing it in the early stages. It was a punk song. It was really fast.
Right. And then yeah, I have like a live bootleg from like 81 where you guys are just speeding through it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was a huge Ramones fan, still am, but at that time that's, you know, I listened to the Ramones every single day for a couple of years. That was my morning workout, not workout, but my morning, wake up listening thing was one of three records because I didn't have very many. It was either ABBA's Greatest Hits, the Ramones, or Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers. Those are the listening to one of them at least every day.
I saw somewhere that your favorite band growing up was Three Dog Night. Is that true?
That is pretty up there. I mean,
I felt a special connection to them. Great singing, really good band, and whoever was picking their songs for them knew what they were doing. It was really, I was really thrilled to, at the Songwriters Hall of Fame, I got to meet Paul Williams, who, of course, wrote Out in the Country, which we covered as a B-side. And he was thrilled to hear that he'd actually heard it. He knew about it. And he said it was really good. I said, thank you. That means a whole lot, because it was kind of my project to make that B-side. And I sang it. And he was, so Paul Williams was happy with it. And boy, I'm sure happy with it.
Paul Williams, I had on, I talked to him for Carol Pop, and he's like one of the nicest, smartest guys. He was fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, it was super cool to meet and chat with him.
So going back to Rockville, so you had this kind of Ramonesy version, and then for Reckoning, it's this more country version. Did you guys do that as kind of a joke originally? Like, let's just do it like this and see. Like, because even like on the record, there's this kind of goofy little intro to it, which is sort of like, all right, we're just kind of messing around right now.
There were a lot of like messy little things. You know, we wanted, as a band, we were very serious about what we did, but we didn't take it seriously. If you can be both things at that same time, I think we were. We countrified it as a little bit. I can't remember something Burtis Downs, our manager Burtis, said about it that made us play it country, countrify it a little bit for him. And we liked it so much and it sounded cool. So that's how we were playing it at that time. So we just threw it on the record that way.
Right. Early on, I was pretty obsessive and I was getting like your B-sides and like Burning Hell, which was very funny. Your cover of Tighten Up. And it was clear that you guys were just like having fun in the studio, messing around with a lot of these songs, even as your reputation was, this is like a serious art band or something like that. But I'm like, well, if you listen to it, they're also cutting up, you know. Was there sort of a disconnect between, you know, the sort of the seriousness and the fact that you guys are all funny actually?
Well, there wasn't a disconnect for us. It might have been for other people. You know, we didn't smile in our photographs. We didn't, we would tell the photographers, we don't cavort, we don't gamble, you know, we don't jump up in the air as a rule and do silly things. We just take our pictures and we don't really smile. It's just get it done. You know, it's a function. It's not, we're not, when we're making, you know, the photographs, we're not making art. We're trying to just get the word out about the record. But obviously we were having a great time, you know, and Michael had a very serious public persona. He was, you know, quote unquote enigmatic. And since he's the front man, that gets sort of attached to the rest of the band. But the fact is, you know, we all have great senses of humor and we all had a lot of fun doing what we were doing. And that's why you put those little fun things, the interstitial things in the records, so people could get an idea that, you know, this, while we happened to be making great art, we were doing it for fun and with a sense of humor.
And did that spirit persist throughout your career? Or did it, you know, when you were playing bigger places and working for a bigger, you know, working with a bigger label, did that mood shift?
I wouldn't say it shifted a whole lot. Obviously, there is a different, when you're playing arenas for, you know, months and months on end, it requires a different focus. When you come out on stage, you know, we would still have fun, but you really have to pay attention to what you're doing, because you can't be, even though we were loose for a big arena band, we were still, you know, you still have to be as tight as you can be, because it's just not the same as being in a little club. So we were still having fun and still enjoying it. You know, the set list changed every night depending on what we wanted to play. But on the other hand, you know, you do have to be, a certain level of professionalism is required.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and also I think just, you know, when you're playing bigger places, there's a little more choreography involved, a little more presentation in the way Michael was, you know, whatever his makeup and his movements were, as opposed to, you know, I think when I saw you in Philadelphia, I think it was the night after that, your first Letterman appearance, and you played South Central Rain and still didn't have a name for it. And part of it was just that, you know, like, he's sort of, you know, his eyes are rolling in the back of his head and you guys were just playing, and it wasn't, it was more like we were sort of leaning into you, like, what's going on with this band? And then later, because when you're playing a bigger place, you have to kind of present more to, you know, people in the back row and everything else. And so, it felt in the audience like it was a slightly different thing that you had to do because of just who you were playing for and where you were in the careers and everything else.
Well, it's not so much have to do it. You can always choose not to. We didn't have to have big screens with words and all behind it. But we wanted the fans that couldn't afford a front row ticket to enjoy it as much as we could make it possible for them to enjoy it. And yes, that does mean playing to the back row if you can. It does mean having some larger visual interests. You know, we want it to be a fun, interesting thing for everyone that comes. So, and of course, with that, you know, when you have screens and movies and things, it does require, you do have a little bit less flexibility. But, you know, by the time we got to the encore, we had them written out, but that doesn't mean that's what we played.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that, like each time I saw you, a lot of times I would see you, you would play whatever the single for the next album was would somehow show up in your set list. So like on the Murmur tour, you're playing South Central Rain, and on the Reckoning tour, I'm hearing Driver 8. And then I think the Fables tour, you're playing Fall on Me. Yeah. I think One I Love was on the next one. Orange Crush was on the next one. So you always were sort of throwing new stuff in, you know, at any point, I was seeing you.
Oh, absolutely. Any new song we had, that was good enough, we'd put it in the set. We didn't know they were going to be singles or not. That was never a consideration, because who knew? But if we had new songs, we loved it because, you know, Peter and I, especially Peter, had gone to see people. He saw so many bands as a younger man because he lived in Atlanta and in California and places where he could go see bands. I lived in Macon where you didn't have that many options. But Peter loved to go see bands, and when they would play new songs, because he's such a dedicated listener. He knew the albums and he knew what songs were on the albums, and he would hear things at work and go, that's really, really cool. So we decided that as soon as we had new songs, we liked it. Plus it made it more fun for us. It takes a while to get tired of playing a song if it's a great song, but still it's nice to keep them fresh. And if you have something brand new that you can trot out, it makes it more fun for you. Also, It keeps you on the edge a little bit because these are songs that you haven't played very much and you may not know as well as you know the other ones. And having that sort of a little bit of self-imposed pressure keeps you from getting complacent.
Right. Yeah, I think even on the Green Tour, you guys played Low and Belong, which were already kind of changes of pace, you know, for that kind of show. But it was just like, oh, cool. So
yeah, I doubt we were... I mean, you have to. The only thing we were probably thinking then was you got to be careful about slow songs. You don't want to have too many, and you don't want to have them too close to each other. That's the kind of crafting that goes on with the set list. But you know, Low's a cool song, and we knew it. As long as it doesn't drag the set down, there's no reason not to throw it in there.
Right, and that was before everything was showing up on YouTube, so you wouldn't have to worry about like, oh, you know, now people are downloading or listening to our new song before we've even recorded it, which is, you know, I feel like a lot of bands now are much more protective about their sets because of YouTube and the internet.
Yeah, I understand that completely. I would probably be the same way. We were so fortunate in so many ways that we got to, you know, to grow and learn in relative obscurity and privacy, whether just because we were in Athens or because there was no internet, you know, documentation. We were able to do things at our own pace and in our own time. And that was a very important thing for us, which, you know, we didn't realize at the time, but looking back, I'm very grateful that we had that.
And the train conductor says, take a break, driver eight, take a break. We've been on this ship too long. And the train conductor says, take a break.
Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great offerings include the classic Anti-Hero IPA, the non-alcoholic sparkling hop water Super Zero, and the premium lager Cold Time. No matter the weather, Cold Time hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. In those early years, I mean, you really were, you're putting out an album and, you know, in my mind, a great album every year. You know, Peter's writing songs, you're writing songs, Bill's writing songs, you're handing stuff off to Michael, he's putting, you know, melodies, lyrics on top of it. Was that a pace that was hard to keep up as you kept going?
Songwriting is hard, put it that way. But it's also something that we knew from the very beginning was one of the most important aspects to what we did. Peter and I just somehow knew that we wanted to write songs together and sit and play guitar all day and come up with songs because it was so exciting when you hit something good. It's such a joyous feeling to have written what you know is a good song. And so that was something we just did as often as possible. Obviously, the more you tour, the less time you have to write songs, but that never stops. But you know, there were times we didn't have enough. I mean, that's why we put Strange on, I guess that's on Document.
Right. And Superman on Life Search Pageant before
Superman
that.
On Pageants. I mean, Superman's a song we were doing live that we loved anyway, but yeah, I mean, whatever we had written, if either we didn't have enough or we didn't think it was good enough. So we put those on the record, but that was very definitely the exception to the rule.
Right. Yeah, that album also had Hyena and Just a Touch, which are older songs for you guys. So
I suppose so, yeah. So which album was that?
Pageant? Life Search Pageant? Yeah.
Yeah.
Still a great record. I mean, none of those are bad songs. Hyena's great. So
yeah, you know, that was an exciting record to make. You know, we had a great studio, springtime in a college town. It was a lot of fun.
Did Don Gaiman produce you guys differently? Like, did he record instruments separately, or were you still playing live?
Oh, God. Well, he was very different, yes, especially when you contrast it to Joe Boyd in that weird little studio in London. No, Don was very, very technical, much more detail-oriented about recording. You know, he challenged us to keep our game high. He challenged Michael as a lyricist. I'll tell you a funny story I don't always tell you. When I went to, we were doing Flowers of Guatemala, and I said, I think I'm going to put a B3 on that. And I sit down, I get the headphones on, and he goes, are you qualified? And I said, what? He said, never mind. Because the B3, you know, there's a lot to it. And if you, he didn't know that I'd played one before. He didn't know that I had a pretty good idea of how they worked. And, you know, working a Leslie is it's not difficult, but it's something you have to know how to do. So he was just unaware that I had a pretty good idea of what I was about to do.
Well, the word qualified is so funny, too.
Well, I could tell it wasn't the word he really wanted to use. I could tell he was searching. Are you qualified? You know, he was just trying to find out what I knew about the B3. So,
you should have said, was Al Cooper qualified on Like a Rolling Stone?
Well, I would not put myself into Al's league, but I here's the thing. I know enough to do what I want to do. I'm not an expert on very many things, but I know enough to be able to get my ideas into reality.
Right. Yeah. So what role did producers play with REM overall? I mean, obviously you then went on after the one with Gaiman to a bunch with Scott Litt. Like how important was the producer in, you know, those records?
Producers are always extremely important, at least to REM they were, because we co-produced every record. I mean, we know what we want and we know what we don't want. We don't always know how to get it. And also, you know, when you producers do a number of good things for a band, they, you know, being a 2-2 band, we would often have, you know, 2-2 in the sense of what do we do with this? Do we like this part? Do we not like this part? Well, 2 of us liked it and 2 of us didn't. It's the job of a producer to make that decision without pissing off 2 guys.
Right.
They also make suggestions. They all say, look, this chord. I remember one time for Supernatural Super Serious, Jack Knife Lee, I wrote it, and he said, that chorus why don't you make the chorus the bridge and write another chorus? And I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, sure. That's easy as pie. but he was absolutely right. What is now the chorus of Supernatural Super Serious, what's now the bridge, excuse me, was the chorus. And the chorus I came up with is actually a much, much better chorus. So, and that's a favorite song of both mine and Michael's. And I'm really thrilled that Jackknife knew enough to tell me to go do some more work on it.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the bridge of that. I could see the bridge works as a bridge. So, yeah, it's a good chorus.
Yeah.
Good to get shoved on that stuff. Like the Scott Litt stuff, it seems like it everything's presented very clearly. Fables, which I love, is obviously a sort of murky record. And then, you know, Life's Rich Pageant bounces more out of the speakers and sounds like these days sounds like what you sounded live. And then Document is sort of that, but maybe without some of that reverb or whatever that was that Gaiman brought to it. Was Scott Litt's main thing that he just sort of let you guys sound like yourselves the way you thought you sounded?
I don't think it was that thought out. We cut when Don decided not to do the next record. He said, "I got a guy you might like." He was managed by the same guy Don was. So we went and cut a track with Scott called "Romance" or "Romance," as we would say it down south. And we liked it. We thought it sounded really good. We liked working with him. We liked what he did with it. We liked the sounds he got. You know, none of us were ever and are not now engineers. And Scott was both engineer and producer for a little bit, for a while. And because he got great sounds and we liked the sounds he got, and then he also had great ideas in the studio. So that was just a collaboration made in heaven there.
See, and I knew Scott from Repercussion, the DBs album, and had kind of assumed that somehow Peter Holsapple had connected you guys, because I think he'd also connected you with Mitch originally. Was there a connection there too, or was it really just a coincidence?
No, coincidence. I mean, we liked the fact that he'd done Repercussion. We certainly were huge fans of that record, but this was more that we had to find somebody, and Don made a suggestion, and there's no reason not to at least follow up on his suggestion, and it turned out to be a great one. But no, it was Holsapple, while he did definitely hook us up with Mitch, did not have anything to do with Scott Litt.
And when you had these two and two arguments, did the two seem to, was it usually the same two and two, or would you guys sort of, sometimes it was you and one person, sometimes it was you and someone else?
Well, it wasn't, you know, I'd say two, it wasn't always two and two. Sometimes it was just one and one. Like one person would really have a very strong opinion about something and another person would have a very strong opinion against that. I don't mean to sound as two and two sounds more divisive than it really was, or divisive. How do you say it? It's divisive.
I think you can go either way.
Go either way. Well, it wasn't, you know, I don't want it to sound like it was factions. It wasn't like that. But, you know, we just had strong opinions about ideas sometimes. So, and sometimes it was one-on-one, sometimes one-on-two, you know, it just depends on who was there and who cared. Not everybody cared about every single thing that went on the record.
Right. Well, I mean, you guys are in a band, so I don't expect you to say, you know, we never disagreed. We co-wrote all the songs and never disagreed on any aspect of any of the songs. Like, I assume you guys had a pretty healthy back and forth on a lot of this stuff.
I mean, you have to. I mean, it's great when you don't. It's great when everybody's on exactly the same page. But sometimes one guy's right and one guy's wrong. And that's just something you have to deal with. And that's what a producer, that's one of the hardest job a producer has to do, is to make that decision without alienating anybody in the band.
Do you remember any times where you were pushing for something and didn't get your way, and later you were like, oh, you know, it turned out okay anyway?
Oh, you know, I can't think of any right now, but I do know that I have thought that over the years or there are a couple of things where I did get my way and wished I hadn't, you know, but nothing is perfect. No record, very few records, you know, they may be perfect to the listener, but they're seldom perfect to the people who made them.
Right. Are there certain records you want to go back and tweak stuff? Not that you would, but although you guys did, Scott Litt did it with a new mix of Monster.
Yeah. Scott wanted to remix that. He asked if he could. We said, sure. You know, if you're going to reissue something, you should, you know, try to bring something new to the table. And he wanted to do it. And we have the ultimate respect for Scott Litt. So we said, sure, go for it. I wouldn't, you know, to go back to think about what you would go back and change is a fool's errand. You just drive yourself crazy, because we're not going to do it. there's no point in sitting there and trying to find negative aspects of what you've done to say, well, that sucks. I want to fix that, but I can't. You know, there's just no reason to introduce that sort of negativity into your thinking.
No, it drove me crazy, like that George Lucas would go back into Star Wars and those movies and quote unquote fix stuff. I'm like, no, you know, and you're using different technology and you can see it later. And I was just saying this to someone else. It's like every Beatles record has a quote unquote mistake on it. And who cares? They're Beatles records, you know?
So many of those early records, one of them is singing the wrong verse. When John and, well, I guess and sometimes George too, but when John and Paul are singing dual lead, it's amazing how many times one of them sings the wrong verse. I've seen him do it live.
Right.
So, you know, so it's just fascinating that, and yet it sounds fine. It's so weird. In Rockville, in that B section of Rockville, I think there's a place where I'm playing a B major and Peter's playing a B minor or vice versa. And we didn't realize it at the time because it sounds fine. I don't know how, but it works.
Right. When you guys would give stuff over to Michael, how often were you, I mean, maybe how often isn't the right word. Do you remember songs in particular where you were especially surprised at what he came up with, given what you know, guys had handed off to him?
Oh, always. Sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. You know, Everybody Hurts is a fairly simple song musically, but obviously Michael took it to Skyscraper Heights. I thought that World Leader Pretend? I thought World Leader Pretend was going to be a super pop song, and I was very disappointed with what Michael did with it. But now I love it. You know, at the time I was expecting something much catchier and poppier. And it was this sort of morose kind of, you know, inward looking thing that I only because I just didn't expect it. But I love it. It didn't take long before I realized it was great.
It's so funny. I mean, I'm just going to confess this just as a fan. When that album came out, I remember hearing that song and thinking it had such a meandering melody. And I thought, you know, I bet they like turned in like this like super great track and thought it was going to be like what you just said was actually what I assumed at the time, because I thought, you know, it was you guys printed the lyrics of that. It was like the first song there were lyrics printed. I thought this seems to be like a major song to them, but melodically it's so kind of like meandery in a way that I don't get it. And it has grown on me. And it's funny because the first time I heard Losing My Religion, I just thought, oh, that's kind of a meandery song. And then like the third time I heard it, I'm like, oh, this is great. So yeah, you never know.
Well, when Peter brought in I Believe, and Bill and I were just like, this is insane. It's just these chords that go around and around and they don't make any sense and it doesn't happen the same way. And what the hell is this? And so it took us forever to learn it and get it down because, in Peter's head, it made sense. We didn't, you know, when you have a vision for your own song, it's easier, you know, it's easy for you to see it, but sometimes it's hard to bring somebody else along. And so Bill and I, for the longest time, were like, this is ridiculous. How's anybody going to write to this? And then Michael took it and it became one of my absolute favorite songs. So you just never know what somebody's going to do with something.
Was that one of the titles that was on the cover of Fables and then actually showed up on Life Search Pageant? I think maybe it was called When I Was, maybe it was on, I don't have it in front of me, but my memory is that Fables said When I Was Young, I think was one of the titles listed, which isn't on the album. And then When I Believe was on the next one, I thought, oh, I wonder if that's the same song.
It probably was. I mean, there are a lot of working titles, you know, you don't always have the final title right away. So you call them things like Country Feedback. That was a working title, but
sure.
It made sense. So it stayed on as the song title.
When Bill left the band and it was three of you instead of four of you as a songwriting collective, the sort of the triangles are like harder in terms because everything's going to be two and one instead of two and two. Was that like a key thing? Like, was that one of the big hurdles you guys had to get over, was trying to figure out how to do it when there are only three of you and the dynamics just different?
Well, of course. I mean, it was just a major shift in every way. The songwriting, the main difference in the songwriting was Bill was more the editor. Bill was the guy to say, okay, we don't need that. That's too long. Let's get rid of that. Bill was always ready to get on with it in every phase of life. And in songwriting, that really helped a lot. It helped us edit. And as you can see, you know, we made a couple of records that had some very long songs on it, songs that could have been shorter. The whole records could have been shorter. So I think without Bill, we lost a little bit of that editing gene that we had before. So, so that's one reason. And after Around the Sun, when we went in to cut to do Accelerate, we just said, we're going to take that out, make it shorter. Every song we took things out that we would normally have left in to make it as concise as possible as a reaction to Around the Sun. So it was a good idea. You know, some of the cuts may not have been necessary, but on the whole, it was necessary for us to make that kind of record.
Interesting. Yeah, no, because that Around Accelerate is kind of like you return to the vinyl era album, where it would have just fit very comfortably on two sides of vinyl, whereas pretty much from Monster through Around the Sun, the last two that Bill was on were still pretty long records, and New Adventures in Hi-Fi has some pretty long songs on that as well. Even with him there, I think, you know, some of them are like seven minutes or something. So I don't know if you guys were fighting over that at the time or not, but
not really. I mean, we always felt that everything in the song needed to be there. You know, we didn't want a bloated song for no reason. Everything had a purpose. But sometimes you have to write longer songs. Sometimes you can only churn out so many 3-minute pop songs. Sometimes you have to broaden your palette a little bit and write some more pastoral things or longer things or things that take a little bit longer to develop. Like Leave is a very strange song. It takes a long time to develop. But, you know, again, some of those songs, too, we were cutting at soundcheck, working on them at soundcheck every day and then cutting them at soundcheck. And the editing process may not have been as foremost in our minds as it was at other times.
Right. Well, it's just this road album where, you know, you wrote stuff under and recorded it under these sort of specific circumstances, as opposed to it, you know, you were just in the studio for a couple weeks and pounded it out that way. So it captures whatever that experience was, which included some songs like Leave that are pretty long. So,
yeah, it was Peter's way of not wasting 2 hours at soundcheck every day. And also, go ahead and get the next record done. You know, why wait till we finish and then have to start all over again? Let's just go ahead and get the next record going. Since we always did that anyway, we always were writing songs, which were going to be on the next record. He said, why don't we just go ahead and write and record as much of the next record as we can? And it turned out to be a cool idea. You know, it added work, you know, to go in the sound check. You know, you normally you go in and you do a couple of songs, sound check, you're done. But this was, you know, this was like going to the office in a way. And so you're going to, when you go to soundcheck, you're going to work. And that was something that most people just don't do.
Yeah. And I remember on that tour too, like you were playing again, you know, as a Monster tour and you're playing new and you hadn't toured for Automatic or Out of Time. So it was really the first time people had seen you in a while and you were pulling out, I think there's a song called Revolution that you did that didn't even end up on New Adventures in Hi-Fi. But I remember there were new songs in that. I think you played Wake Up Bomb on like the MTV Awards and nobody had heard that at that point. So again, it was still, even when you were sort of at that height of everyone knowing you, you were still pulling out this new stuff.
Well, it's, you know, we enjoyed challenging our audiences, but we also enjoyed challenging ourselves. It's, we never wanted to be, you know, to feel like a pet monkey, you know, or we're, you know, like a jukebox, you know, the whole idea is that this is our band and we present it in the way that we want to present it. And if you don't like it, then find somebody else.
So by the end, when you're writing songs, Peter's writing songs, was there at some point like a backlog of stuff you'd given to Michael that you're kind of waiting for, you know, the finished song? And like, did the mechanism keep working as smoothly toward the end, or was it, you know, were you guys a little more out of sync by then? And if so, are there these kind of like maybe unfinished, you know, REM songs that are just, you know, in some state or other that just didn't quite get to the finish line?
Yeah, there are a bunch of unfinished songs. There are a lot of things that we wrote that Michael, you know, I'm not saying he didn't like them, but he was not inspired to write to them. So there were a lot of those things. There are a few things that he wrote some of that for one reason or another never got finished. There are probably a few that he wrote that did get more or less finished, but we just didn't decide where they did either. They usually, because they didn't fit. It's not because they weren't good enough. It's just usually that they didn't fit on the record. And there are several of those still floating around. We release them as we find a good time and place to release them. If they sound good and they're worth putting out there, you know, some kind of compilation might require a song and we'll do that. But mostly things that didn't get put out there are fine staying where they are.
So there's not, you're not going to sort of go back in and finish up a bunch of the stuff and have the great lost REM record or something like that.
Doubt it. That seems a little, I mean, we maybe, you never know. I mean, Peter and I could go sit and comb through stuff and see what we find that's really good. I don't know. We've never really seriously considered it. I think we probably talked about it a little bit, but we've never tried to make it a reality.
And Michael hasn't shown interest in going. I mean, the ones that he wasn't as interested in, then he's not like, oh, let me finish these up now.
Well, see, no, because REM's done. You know, REM's over. As far as a creative band. So that's something that when you manage to become at peace with that, you don't want to go back and start shaking that foundation again. It's like, this is done. You know, let's not go entice ourselves with reworking old songs.
You're not going to go the Neil Young route where there are like 55 albums that were never released that were like, oh.
No, that's not going to happen. I mean, who knows what will happen, but no, we have no plan or intention of revisiting things to put them together to put out.
A couple of years, I think it was like November of 2023, I'd seen an interview with you where you talked about how you were working on a solo album, but you weren't sure if it was going to get done or not, but you were working on it. Is anything happening with that, or is that kind of to the side again now that you have this new project?
You know, I've just never been driven to put out a solo record. I don't think my voice would hold up over an entire record. I'd have to bring in all my friends to sing on it, which is doable. And when I say hold up, I think it would just start to sound a little thin after a while. I'm a great harmony singer. I'm a great co-lead singer. I don't know that my voice has the gravitas to pull off an entire record. Plus, I've found that I work better with other people. I'm really good at bouncing ideas. I'm really good at taking other people's ideas and turning them into something maybe even a little bit better. I'm a great collaborator. I don't know that I need or want to make a solo record. So right now, no, that's on hold.
Yeah, interesting. So did you actually record stuff or just write or...
No, I've never recorded anything thinking of a solo record. I've written a lot of things and recorded a lot of things thinking, you know, yes. And having said that, yeah, there were some things I wrote thinking might be on a solo record, but some of it I used on a concerto.
That was my next question, is if we were going to do a follow-up to the concerto.
I doubt it. The Start Answers Waltz on the concerto was something I'd written that I was saving for something. And then when I realized I needed another song for the concerto, I said, what am I saving it for? Let's put it in here. And it's a high point of the concerto. It's pretty great. But no, I have no plans to write another concerto at this point. This one still has, you know, as much legs as it has. We're still performing it. I'm actually performing it in Athens, Ohio in a couple of weeks. So,
oh, nice. Yeah.
It's still out there and still being played and we're still enjoying it, but I don't really want to write a bunch of classical music either.
Yeah, there are people who just seem like they're band people as opposed to people who want to do the solo thing. That said, I would totally listen to a full album of you singing songs. So it wouldn't be too thin for me. But, you know, that's not my choice. But I would not discourage you from doing that, certainly.
Well, thank you. You never know. I mean, it could happen. But right now, I'm really enjoying collaborating with all the people I work with.
And how is it going back to work with Mitch Easter on the last Baseball Project record?
Oh, like we never left. I mean, Mitch and I have kept in touch over the years. You know, I've worked with him. I've worked at the Fidelatorium on several. I've sang with my friend Django's band, The Old Ceremony. We've cut some Christmas singles there together. I've worked with Mitch a lot over the years, and we've maintained that friendship. And, you know, he plays in some of the big star compilation groups that we do. So, it was just super nice to go back and work with Mitch. We're very simpatico.
When you were a kid and you were sort of envisioning the music career you might have, like how close did what you did come to what you had sort of imagined for yourself?
I never envisioned a music career for myself. When I was old enough to actually start thinking about it, I realized that I'd always play music, even if it was just sitting around the house. I never dreamed that I'd get paid for it or have a career at it. Even when we started REM, we weren't thinking it would be a career. We were just looking to have some fun and play some music and get some beers. And it just turned into a bigger thing because, you know, with the magic, the chemistry of the four people, it just propelled it forward.
Absolutely. And just because I follow you on Twitter and, you know, have known how you think to some extent for a while, does music now have any sort of different role given what's happening in the country and the world?
I wish I could say no, but I don't know that it has much of a role at all. I mean, apparently Kendrick Lamar did some pretty subversive things in his Super Bowl halftime performance, but I wasn't paying enough attention to pick up on a lot of the subtleties of what he was doing and saying. But apparently there were some subliminal messages there. But on the whole, I think that society is so fragmented, music is so fragmented, that and the powers that be have managed to convince people so well to work against their own self-interests, that both very politically and in music, they've made people more cynical, to where if somebody says, you know, writes an anti-establishment song, there are far too many people who are willing to put that down as I can't even think of the words, but they're willing to dismiss it as, oh, you know, who are you to be telling me what to do? I don't want to hear Hollywood. I don't want to hear musicians talk about politics. Well, who should be talking about politics? Everyone should be talking about politics. Are we only going to let politicians and idiots on TV talk about politics? No, everyone should talk about politics, and musicians, if they're so inclined, should write and sing about politics, because everything's political. At the end of the chart, everything is political, and you should just keep that in mind sometimes.
Right. I was following Eric Carmen on Twitter way back or early on, and we would have back and forth about like McCartney and stuff, and then all of a sudden he just went kind of nuts.
The day he followed me, I texted everybody I knew. I said, Eric Carmen just followed me on Twitter. And we had some great interchange, just like you. We had some great
exchanges. I remember this.
And then all of a sudden he drank the Kool-Aid. I don't know what happened to him, but he went way off the deep end. And, you know, I tried to have some, you know, adult discussions with him about it, but he was so down the rabbit hole that he couldn't even discuss it. He was just convinced that Trump was the savior and everybody else was just going to hell. And I was like, okay, I'm done.
I know. Yeah, I'm like, don't do that, because I really like those songs. I don't want to think about where you're coming from right now. I want to keep listening to Overnight Sensation.
Exactly, which is another part of the reason I quit, you know, engaging or following him, was because I never want to not enjoy those songs, because the Raspberry is one of my favorite bands ever, so I certainly don't want to blow that.
Absolutely. For the Tribune, I covered the Vote for Change concert in Philadelphia in 2004, I think it was when Kerry was on the ballot, and you guys played at this, I don't know if it was still the Spectrum back then, whatever the Philly basketball arena was, and it was REM and Springsteen. And I remember you coming out for the encore of Born to Run, and you look like you're just having the best time. And I just thought, this is so cool just to be up here for this moment, because this is just like, whatever you think of the politics of it, it was just this kind of joyous moment of, you know, you playing on this older song that still, obviously, to me, you were getting a big kick out of being part of.
Well, it was definitely a career highlight, and I owe Peter for that, because Bruce had asked him to come up and play on Born to Run. And so I'm sitting out in the audience while they're rehearsing, and I'm sitting there feeling sorry for myself, like, God damn, guitar players always get to do this kind of stuff. And Peter said something to Bruce, and Bruce pointed at me, and I literally turned around to see who was behind me that he could be pointing to. And I said, me? Tap my chest. He said, yeah, come on up here. He says, you want to play bass on this? It's a great story. So he says, you want to play bass on this? I said, sure. He said, okay, go talk to Gary. I said, all right. So I go talk to Gary. I said, Gary, do you mind? He said, no, man, come on. So we'll play bass together. He said, we ought to do something, though, to make it. I said, two basses playing the same thing is a little weird. He says, okay. He says, why don't you play fuzz bass? I said, great, I'll play fuzz bass. So after a while, Bruce comes over. He says, so what are you guys going to do? I said, well, Bruce, Gary's going to play his part, and I'm just going to play the same thing on fuzz bass. And Bruce goes, fuzz bass? Whoa. And then we played the song, and then he came back over and he looked at me, he goes, "Fuzz bass. Whoa." And I said, "Man, that's the coolest thing that's ever happened." So yeah, that was I definitely owe Peter for that one.
Oh, that's fantastic. All right. Well, thank you so much. I mean, I've seen you and heard you so many times. So this has been a real treat. Oh, and I just realized something else I didn't ask you, but I really should let you go.
Well, so, quick, if you got one more, go ahead.
All right, I'm going to slip this in. When I saw the baseball project at the Cubby Bear, and it was not long after Collapse Into Now had come out, and it was not a crowded, it was not a well-promoted show, and you were just kind of standing out, being just like a regular guy, and I was chatting with you, and I was asking you about Collapse Into Now, and I was like, "Hey, you know, I haven't seen you guys do any sort of, you know, promotional, like any TV appearances on this record. You know, there's no tour. Are you doing anything to push this record? Because it's a good record." And you're just like, "You know, we're at the point in our careers where we, you know, we really don't have to do what we don't want to do. And we just don't want to do that. You know, the record's the record." And it was sort of that. And I remember, you know, calling my friend when I got home going, "I think REM broke up." And then you guys like announced you broke up like, I don't know, months later. But I've always wondered, like, then you go back and listen to Collapse Into Now and you listen to, you know, All the Best and you see Michael waving, you know, on the cover. And I'm like, you guys knew that was it, right?
We were pretty sure of it. Yeah. We spoke at the end of the 2008 tour and you know, talked about the future and we were all pretty much on the same page. We were actually all three going to bring that up to the others separately, and then ended up all doing it together. So, yeah, we knew that Collapse would be our last record. Yeah. The record deal was over. The record industry was turning to God knows what. So we said, "Yeah, let's get out of here, and while we can still do other things."
So, well, it's a good one, as most of them, as really they all are, but. But I remember, like, I just remember having that conversation with you, and that was like, REM's done. They're gone. Like, that was it. Yeah, that was it. Because yeah. They would have done something to promote that record because it's a good record. Anyway, Okay. Thank you so much. I'll see you next time you're here with your new band or with the baseball project or with the Big Star guys or whatever else, because you do cool stuff and I'll be there for it. So
thanks, Mark. Really enjoyed it. Look forward to seeing you again soon.
That's all for episode 170 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Mike Mills for taking us inside the worlds of REM, the Baseball Project, his new band, and his deeply creative mind. It was a real treat. Seek out his music. You know where to find it. Also, if you're still on Twitter X, he's a great follow at @M_Millsy. Caropop is produced by Chris Swake, who always knows what's the frequency. If you'd like to throw something into the Caropop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caropop on the so-called socials at @CaroPopcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at @MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caropop conversation. Thanks.